Okay, friends, so I'm really happy to welcome Matthew F. Delmont to the show. Matt's the author of Half American, the epic story of African Americans fighting World War II at home and abroad. And let me tell you something, I really, really loved this book. It is accessible, it is well written, it is well argued. I reviewed it on my website, I reviewed it on YouTube, I talked about it on Instagram, I've told my students about it. I mean, this is just a fantastic book, and so I'm excited to have Matt on the show to come and talk all about it. And let me tell you something, I was really annoyed because, you know, I didn't learn this stuff in high school, and I wish I had. I make sure to teach my own students about this kind of thing, because I don't think that you can really understand World War II without understanding multiple perspectives, including the black perspective. And Matt makes the argument that you can't really understand World War II at all unless you get the black perspective on this conflict. And I tend to agree with him. So listen to the show. Tell me what you think. And please, by all means, subscribe. You know how to do that kind of thing. Just hit the subscribe button wherever you happen to listen to this sort of stuff. And comment and do all that kind of thing. And I'd love to hear from you. So enjoy the show. Here we go.
Progress. That means we're on, Matt. It's nice to see you. Thanks for coming on, man.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, good. So, listen, I got your new book here, Half American: The Epic Story of African Americans Fighting World War II at Home and Abroad. And I have reviewed this on my website, and I have reviewed it on my YouTube channel. And for those of you who have seen it, you know that I really, really like this book. This is an excellent book. There's a couple of things that are going on here that I think is the reasons why I particularly like this book. First of all, it's accessible. I think, and I don't want to throw my you know, academic friends and colleagues under the bus, but sometimes I think academics have a tendency of writing things that are inaccessible to the general public with esoteric language and, you know, jargon and various other things. And you seem to avoid this completely. And I love the tone of the book. And I love how your well-read, history-loving member of the general public will be able to grasp this and understand it and be able to engage it. And so I love that. And secondly, what I love about this is a story that you don't hear very much, and it's a story that, I mean, I think it's coming out more these days, especially in popular culture. With black servicemen and women during the Second World War. Recently, I just watched Masters of the Air on Apple TV, which was is sort of the third in the series of the Spielberg, Tom Hanks collaboration on World War II common fighting people. And there's a great Tuskegee Airmen section of that, which I thought was pretty good. And Tuskegee Airmen are interesting. And then people have talked about the Tuskegee Airmen before. It's a great story to combine, but I'm interested in how you were drawn to the subject, to begin with. I always ask all my historians who come on the show, what draws them, to study, this particular element, this particular group of people in this particular conflict. So I'll let you take it from there.
Awesome. Well, Keith, thanks so much again for having me on. And I'm really glad that you liked how the book was written. It was definitely my aim to try to write this for a general audience and make it accessible and really let the story lead, not get caught up in too much of the jargon or other things that are out there, but really kind of focus on the story because it is an amazing, amazing story. So in terms of what led me to the book, it actually grew out of the last book project that I worked on. That was a digital book project called Black Quotidian, Everyday History in African-American Newspapers. And listeners can actually find it for free online at blackquotidian.org. It was published by Stanford University Press, but just as an online project. For that book, I was looking at these historical Black newspapers, papers like the Chicago Defender, Pittsburgh Courier, at different points in the 20th century, trying to get a sense of how those newspapers were covering history as it unfolded. When I was looking at those papers from the 1940s during the war years, I kept coming across pictures and stories about the more than a million Black men and women who served in the military during World War II. And these weren't famous people. These were average people from Minneapolis, from Chicago, from Los Angeles, from New York. And there'd be just these pictures and little profiles of soldiers from our town talking about the men and women who were serving in the military. Now, like you, I'm a teacher. I've taught about this topic in the classroom for more than a decade, but I'd never seen this many examples of Black men and women in uniform during World War II. And it was really that experience of coming across all these stories made me curious. I wanted to know what more there was to the story, because these were names and stories that I wasn't teaching in my classroom. They weren't in our textbooks. And so I wanted to get a sense of, if you looked at World War II from the Black perspective and tried to get a better understanding of what the war meant for average Black Americans, what would that story look like? And so it was really that curiosity that led me to the research that resulted in Half American. It was about 7 years ago I started the research that ended up resulting in the book. But it was for me that really, really the experience of seeing these names, seeing these stories in Black newspapers, and then trying to tell the story from that perspective.
You know, I'm a Civil War historian, and one of the things that I focus on when I talk about Black service in the Union Army during the Civil War is the recruiting efforts. And Frederick Douglass in particular, the very famous speech that he made where he's speaking to potential Black recruits, and he's saying, listen, if you, and I'm paraphrasing, of course, but if you join the Union cause and fight under the American flag, what you are doing essentially is fighting for your own citizenship rights, and of course for freedom, but you're fighting for your own citizenship rights. And he says something along the lines of, you know, if you put the eagle on your button and bullets in your pocket and a musket in your hand and that kind of thing, then there's no nation in the world that can deny you the citizenship rights of that country. Now, here we are, many decades later, generations later, Black people are still dealing with the realities of Jim Crow segregation, second-class citizenship at best, and that not just in the South, but all across the country. And yet, it's always seems surprising to me that so many of these men and women would voluntarily enlist their services in a country for a country to support a country that treats them in this particular way, where they're dealing with systemic racism across the board, written into legislation at the state level, supported by the Supreme Court, for some time. Why is it that Black people would be so willing to voluntarily risk their lives for a nation that doesn't afford them the respect of just an ordinary citizen?
It's a great question. It's one I get from my students in the classroom all the time. I think the most easy answer is, in part, it was patriotism, a desire to help defend the country, fight for the country. In part, it was opportunity. Military service provided a paycheck, provided access to job training that could be beneficial after the war. And then once the draft starts, part of it is you get drafted, you have to go. There were some who refused service and actually had to serve time in prison because of it. But that was, I think, the third reason is that if you get drafted, by and large, people were going to serve. But that kind of larger question you're pointing to, part of what I think is powerful about the experience of Black Americans in World War II is the fact that so many do choose to fight is profound, that they choose to fight at a time that they're not being treated as equal citizens. The title of the book actually comes from a letter written by a man named James G. Thompson. James Thompson was a 26-year-old in Wichita, Kansas. And in late December 1941, he writes this amazing letter to the Pittsburgh Courier. This is after the bombing of Pearl Harbor, when he knows that he and other Black Americans are about to be drafted into a segregated military. Thompson's letter asks a series of very pressing and pointed questions. He asked in part, should I sacrifice my life to live half American? Is the America I know worth defending? And that phrase, should I sacrifice my life to live half American, it really stuck with me. It's why I chose Half American as the title of the book. What Thompson's asking is, what does it mean to be asked to fight for, potentially die for, a country that treats you as a second-class citizen? The famous historian Stephen Ambrose has said that the great irony of World War II is that you had the world's largest democracy fighting against the world's worst racist, Adolf Hitler, with a segregated army. Many women like James Thompson recognized the irony at the time. That didn't take historians like myself to come along decades later to point out the hypocrisy. They felt that hypocrisy viscerally in their day-to-day lives. The Pittsburgh Courier used Thompson's letter to launch the Double Victory campaign that became the rallying cry for Black Americans during the war. Black Americans understood themselves to be fighting for both victory over fascism abroad, but also victory over racism at home. And what I argue in the book is part of why that argument for double victory resonates so powerfully is that it was a new way of framing what was actually a very old idea. As you just said, Frederick Douglass and others were using very similar rhetoric during the Civil War to say, if we fight for our country here, fight for freedom in the against the South, that should lead to greater equality after the war. During World War I, W.E. Du Bois makes a similar argument about closing ranks to fight for the country, and that it'll produce more freedom on the other side. In both those cases, we know that the result after the war actually led to worse conditions for Black Americans in many cases. But still in the lead up to World War II, the thinking was, the hope was, that this situation has to be different. The scale of the war is different. The pent-up demands, the raging demands for civil rights and freedom were so much more prominent at that point that the feeling across Black America was, this time has to be different. That's part of what motivated the Double Victory campaign to resonate nationally in the way that it did.
Let's talk about that Double V campaign. That's something that I find extraordinarily interesting. It's something that I didn't learn about in high school myself, really. And this is back in the 80s. Now, I'm sure these days things have changed significantly. But back in the 80s, my history teacher didn't teach me about the Double V campaign, and I find it it was a big gap in my history education at that level. But I mean, this feeds, I think, a lot into the broader civil rights movement that's been going on. We often think of the civil rights movement as the direct action stuff in Montgomery, for example, Selma, for example, in the 1950s. But the broader civil rights movement extends way before that. Early in the 20th, I mean, well, really during Reconstruction, but really getting moving early in the 20th century with the Niagara Movement, various other things, and the efforts, the legal efforts by the NAACP, etc., for desegregation, and that. How does the Double V campaign play into this broader civil rights movement?
I think part of what's important about the Double Victory campaign and World War II more broadly is that I'd say the infrastructure for civil rights gets built out during the course of the war. Obviously, Black Americans have been fighting for freedom well before World War II, and they keep fighting after World War II. But part of what happens during the war is that you have the NAACP in particular starting to form branches all across the country. One of the people I talk about in the book is Ella Baker, one of the pioneering grassroots activists. She's well known for her work in the 1960s with SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. But during World War II, she was the head of branch membership for the NAACP. So she's traveling all across the country, helping to organize local people to form chapters of the NAACP to be able to fight for issues that matter to them and their communities. She held a leadership training workshop to help train people to be leaders in their community. One of the people who attended those workshops was Rosa Parks in Atlanta in 1945, fully a decade before the Montgomery bus boycott. And Ella Baker was wildly successful at her job. When you look at the stats, the NAACP went from being a relatively small organization that was clustered in the Northeast to being a truly national organization that had chapters and members all across the country. Part of what that meant is that they had more dues-paying members to be able to fight larger, more complex civil rights cases coming out of the war. And so if you're to picture it as a map of the United States, now you have pinpoints all over the country of different organizations. Beyond the NAACP, there's also the March on Washington movement that was headed by A. Philip Randolph, one of the most powerful labor leaders in the country. He was the head of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. In the summer of 1941, before the United States officially enters World War II, Randolph threatens to lead 100,000 Black Americans to march on Washington, D.C., unless President Roosevelt agrees to desegregate the defense industries. It was an incredibly bold call at the time because no one had ever threatened to lead a major march of Black Americans at this scale before. Randolph eventually agrees to call off the march in exchange for an executive order that President Roosevelt signs that, at least on paper, does open up the defense industries to more Black Americans. But part of what that March on Washington movement does is helps to prove the power and dynamism of Black political activism. It shows Black people all across the country that if they work together to fight for their rights and to do that vocally and actively, that they can influence federal officials, influence the White House, influence the president to finally pay attention to them. And so under the kind of a big umbrella of the Double Victory campaign, you have this groundswell of civil rights activism happening during the war. At the same time, you have Black Americans doing everything they can to help win the war abroad. Those stories then meet at the end of the war because you have that whole generation of Black veterans that comes back, and many of them become civil rights leaders in their own communities.
And the Black veterans have access to some of the benefits of the GI Bill that we know about?
Not as widely as they should have. The GI Bill, for listeners who aren't familiar with it, is one of the most important pieces of legislation in the 20th century. It's what enables a whole generation of white veterans to be able to move into middle class, provides access to low interest farm mortgages, access to college tuition benefits, access to loans to be able to start businesses. It truly does make homeownership a national norm, makes going to college much more accessible than it had been to previous generations. It really lifts the boats of all white veterans. By and large, Black veterans were not able to access those benefits in the same way that white veterans were. And that discrimination was by design. As that legislation is being drafted, it goes through committees that are dominated by white segregationist Southern politicians. And they make sure that those benefits are going to be distributed at the state and local level rather than at the federal level. And everyone in 1945 knows what that means. It means that you're going to defer to the policies and prejudices of the different states. And that's what happens. When you look at the stats in the late 1940s, 1950s, Black veterans have an incredibly hard time getting access to those GI Bill benefits to be able to get mortgages, to be able to attend college. And it's both in the South and the North as well. There's actually a group of economists at Brandeis University that have tried to calculate what the long-term impact of that discrimination is. And what they found is there's about a $100,000 gap between what an average white veteran from World War II is able to get from those GI Bill benefits and what an average Black veteran was able to get. And the last point I make on this, though, is that there were a number of Black veterans who were able to access the GI Bill. There were thousands. Mm-hmm. And so it's not the case that no one is able to get it. But I think what we can learn from that story is that the Black veterans who were able to access their GI Bill benefits did amazing things. They became lawyers and doctors and architects and engineers. And so part of the argument I would make is that it was really an opportunity cost to the nation, that if the GI Bill hadn't had this discrimination written into it, we would have had a much larger generation of Black professionals that came out of World War II, because those who were able to access the benefits did amazing, amazing things in the years afterwards.
And would you think then that, you know, leading off of that question, would you think that when we start talking about the legacy of racial segregation in the first half of the 20th century and the inability for many Black Americans to establish a baseline of wealth and ownership and various other things, that sets them at a great disadvantage when we move into the later 20th century, when we start seeing those numbers, those disproportionate numbers of accumulated wealth for white middle class and accumulated wealth for Black families, even in the lower end of the middle class range, the numbers are a pretty significant gap between that. So had the GI Bill actually applied across the board, then perhaps we wouldn't see those great disproportionate numbers. And so, you know, if you talk about systemic racism, and a lot of people make the argument that, look, there's no legislation on the books now that says anything about systemic racism, and they're right, there isn't. But if you look, you know, 70, 80 years into the past, and you see those things, and you start to go, well, we have to look at the legacy of this more than we have to look at the actual functioning of the legislative process today, but look at the, you know, from 100 years ago and see how this stuff is written in, you know, and then we can start to better understand the disproportionate numbers.
And that's absolutely right. I mean, if you look at the racial wealth gap we have in our country today, a large portion of that can be traced back to the discrimination that was in the GI Bill. Mm-hmm. One of the main drivers of wealth for most families is home ownership, or being able to go to college and the kind of occupations that provides you access to. Just think about home ownership. For those veterans who came back in 1945, 46, 47, if you're able to buy a home and then watch that home accrue in value and then be able to pass on either the home or the value you get from the home to the next generation, that gives your children the ability to invest that in a business, in their own home, or just to save it and have that be able to generate interest. That starts to accrue and to build and expand over time. And so I think the question is, if your grandparents or great-grandparents were able to buy a home in those years after World War II, and was that enabled by the GI Bill? If it was, there's a good chance that that helped provide a really important foundation for one's family to be able to enter into middle class or above. For too many Black families, they didn't have that ability, because the GI Bill both discriminated, but also it didn't have any provisions to address the rampant discrimination in the mortgage industry. So it didn't do anything to address the kind of discrimination among real estate agents for these VA-backed home loans. And so it was a moment when such a massive infusion of federal funds could have helped to address the inequality that exists in the country. And in fact, it did the opposite, because there was discrimination in the way that the benefits were distributed. It actually helped to widen the inequality that existed racially in the country.
Let's switch gears a little bit. I want to talk about what Black people did during World War II in the service. I think it's pretty fairly well known that it was a discriminated army, a segregated army, excuse me, up until 1948, when President Truman desegregated the military. But World War II, Black servicemen in combat fought in segregated units commanded primarily by white officers. But I know there were some Black officers, at least at the company grade level, during World War II. And I know that they weren't assigned more technical roles, for example, pilots or tankers, or anybody that would operate sophisticated equipment. Was it the standard of the U.S. government to make the assumption, and this is true of the Civil War too, and so I draw a lot of this from my own experience, but is this in the Civil War studies, but is it true that in the 1930s and 40s, building a modern military, that the assumption was is that Black people didn't have the intellectual capacity to operate sophisticated machinery on airplanes and tanks and sophisticated weapons? Would you say that that's still the assumption in the 20th century?
That was the assumption leading into World War II. And even taking a step back, one of the things that was really frustrating for Black Americans in the lead up to World War II is that they knew that Black people had been part of every war that the United States ever fought. The American Revolution, the Civil War, Spanish-American War, World War I. There were 300,000 Black Americans who served in World War I. But between World War I and World War II, the military does almost everything they can to push Black Americans out of the military. And part of it is based on these pseudoscientific ideas about the capacities of Black people. One of the documents I quote in the book is a report that was published by the Army War College in 1925 that argued that Black Americans had a smaller cranial capacity, that they were scared right. of the dark, that they would flee at the first sign of combat. And so this isn't just sort of the isolated ramblings of some crank. This is the official doctrine of the Army. This is what was taught to officers at West Point or officer candidates at West Point. It's what informed the views of that whole generation that goes on to lead in many cases in World War II. And so it was unfortunately, it was the position of the military that Black Americans didn't have the same capacities and capabilities to be able to serve their country. What that meant is they generally blocked them from combat positions, and it meant that they blocked them from advanced technical positions. So by and large, they were in supply and logistical roles, in the more dirty jobs that one would have to do, digging trenches, burial units. In the Navy, they're only assigned to be mess attendants. And again, if we take a step back, that sort of first point that the military was racially segregated during World War II, it took me a long time to really kind of process this, because I've shared that observation to students in the classroom, shared that fact to students in the classroom for a number of years. But when you actually stop to think about it, there was no strategic or tactical reason for the military to be racially segregated during World War II. In fact, it was the opposite. It was wasteful, it was redundant, it meant that they had to do everything in duplicate. It was literally someone's job to make sure that these units maintained segregation in latrines and dining facilities and recreation facilities in troop transport. It meant that the Army was turning away Black Americans who had advanced degrees from Harvard, from MIT, who had advanced language skills, who had technical capabilities that could have helped America win the war. It was really only racial prejudice that led the military to maintain the kind of segregation they did throughout World War II. And so it is a real, I think, testament to the resolve of the Black soldiers, sailors, Marines that served in the war, that despite all this animosity and all of this wrongheaded thinking about what they could do, they still took the positions they were assigned and did everything they could to help America win the war.
You know, it's always confounding to me. I mean, you just brought this up, and I've experienced the same thing when I'm reading this. It's confounding to me that why the government or anybody really would go to the lengths that they did to maintain segregation when it's the most inefficient system. When you think about trying to win a war, to make it as inefficient as possible, it seems like the exact opposite of what you should be doing, right? To have to maintain segregated mess halls, maintain segregated latrines and officers' quarters and barracks and blah, 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 blah. It just seems like so incredibly inefficient and wasteful. And so that's always been confounding. And it confounds my students, too, who are, you know, teenagers who grew up in the 21st century. And this doesn't really ever occur to them that this was the reality, not all that long ago. I mean, there's plenty of people that are still alive that had to deal with this reality as their day to day. And so it doesn't really occur to them. And they seem so confused that they always ask me the question. It's like, why would they go to the trouble? And I say, well, you just really don't then maybe not understand just how deeply entrenched the ideas of the early first half, at least, and then, of course, beyond that, but the first half of the 20th century, especially, how deeply ingrained those ideas are, how important it was to maintain the system. And that still doesn't compute. And I guess maybe it's good that it doesn't compute because they won't repeat it. But, you know,
I think it's exactly right. I think that's what, so my hope for the book is that not only does it give us a whole different number of stories and units and battles to be able to pay attention to and civil rights protests on the home front, a new way of understanding that aspect of African-American history. But I hope it also leads the readers to rethink some of the foundational assumptions that we have about World War II. That when you view the war from the Black perspective, a lot of things change. One of my favorite quotes in the book is from Roy Wilkins, who's one of the leaders in the NAACP. And he said, white Americans would rather lose the war than give up the luxury of racial prejudice. And it's hard to find the lie in that because military segregation was inefficient. The American military was less efficient, less effective. It cost people lives because they maintained segregation. And this was recognized at the time among Black critics, at least. They kept saying, you know, this is, for lack of a better word, this is dumb. Like, this is a terrible way to take advantage of the patriotism and the manpower, the person power of your citizens, right? That we can help win this war faster. We can save the lives of our countrymen if you allow us to participate in a full and equal way. Another example from the book is the series of labor strikes that happen at the war industries later in the war, particularly in 43 and 44. So I think one of the misconceptions we often have about World War II is that it was a time of great national unity, that people came together as Americans and understood their common cause to fight the war. And the reality is, when you look at the evidence, it absolutely was not. There were racial conflicts all across the country, in big cities and small towns, on military bases, including in a lot of these defense industries. There are a number of examples that provide in the book of white workers walking off the job, going on wildcat strikes for days and sometimes weeks at a time, just because a dozen black workers got promoted or because they integrated the bathroom facilities at a different plant. And again, what black editors, civil rights activists said is, you know, these white workers are willing to produce fewer tanks, fewer trucks, fewer bombs. They're going to help our troops win the war. They would rather give up that war production than use the same toilet as a black person. And when you actually sort of sit with that observation and think about what were people actually fighting for, one of the realities that a lot of white Americans saw the maintenance of a racial hierarchy as a goal that was equally important to winning the war, or in some cases more important. They were willing to sacrifice doing what it would take to win the war in order to maintain their place in the racial hierarchy.
Do you think that there's, I talk a lot about American exceptionalism in my classes, and I take it all the way back to the, to the founding and talk about American exceptionalism and these sort of differing visions of what that actually means. And I know I'm getting a little bit off topic now, but it's contextually, I think that it works. And there is an idea that's embedded with at least one of the visions, and there's multiple visions of American exceptionalism, but this idea that a racial hierarchy is part of a person's birthright as an American citizen to maintain this. And that it is not conflicting with American exceptionalism at all. When American exceptionalism involves the principles such as the equality of man, individual liberty, all these kinds of things, but you limit, a lot of people limited the group of people to whom those ideas applied, and therefore, in a sort of weird, convoluted logic, but therefore the maintenance of first slavery and then racial segregation, racial hierarchy, those things were not contradictory at all to the ideas of American exceptionalism. Do you think that that's true well into the 20th century?
I think that's right. I think World War II provides an example of that. I think that's what makes it so powerful, again, going back to the Double Victory campaign. Black Americans were absolutely committed to helping to win the war militarily, but they recognized that wasn't enough. It wasn't enough to defeat Hitler and the Nazis abroad and then come home to a very similar version of white supremacy and racial discrimination here in the United States. And so they're fighting for actual freedom and democracy for all Americans. But that, in many cases, put them in conflict with a lot of their white countrymen who are fighting, yes, to win the war militarily, but then also to maintain the racial hierarchy here in the United States, fighting a sort of single victory campaign. They only wanted military victory, and then they wanted to return to the way things were. That was one of the common refrains for a lot of white people during World War II, is when they did the public polling or would ask veterans, like, what are you fighting for? Like, we're fighting for the way America used to be, right? Those are two separate and almost irreconcilable visions for America, because the way America was in 1938, 1939, 1940 was rampant racial segregation, discrimination, in some cases lynching to keep black people in their place. That was the exact opposite of what black veterans wanted. They didn't want to go back to that same kind of America that treated them as half American. They wanted a new version of the country to come to the foreground. And so I think this history of World War II does open up those questions about American exceptionalism and really what kind of country was it that veterans were coming back to live in? What did they understand themselves to be actually fighting for?
Let's talk about the supportive roles. You make an interesting argument, and this is something we don't often focus on when we look at World War II. We look at combat units overseas in both Europe and the Pacific. We don't often look at support roles and how many men and women were involved in support roles during World War II. And you make the argument that had it not been, you can't predict with 100% accuracy, but had it not been for the supportive roles of Black Americans in World War II, then the likelihood of victory is much less. Let's put it that way. And so you make that argument. And then again, looking at this story from the Black experience in the war, it opens up an entirely new way of interpreting the cause and the goals and the and what it took to actually do this. And so can you explain a little bit about the supportive roles and how essential they were, if equally as essential as the combat units? Can you explain how essential those supportive roles were?
Absolutely. And it's an argument that I didn't anticipate making when I started the book. I didn't think this was going to be one of the key pieces that I wanted to argue, but after I spent some time sitting with the evidence and sitting with what it meant for all of these Black troops to be in these supply and logistical roles, and reading some of the military documents, it became more clear. And so the argument in short is that logistics are an extraordinarily important part of the war, of any war, but particularly World War II, a war on this kind of global scale, that it wasn't just a battle of strategy and will, it was a battle of supply. When you understand it from that perspective, the really vital role that Black troops played becomes all the more important. I think the best example probably is if you think about D-Day. Most Americans are familiar with the D-Day invasions of June 6, 1944. D-Day obviously just stood for day of the invasion. There was still D-Day plus one, D-Day plus two, and it was really the weeks and months after June 6 that turned the tide of the war for the Allies. There are about 2,000 Black Americans that were part of the D-Day invasion itself on June 6, but there were tens of thousands that were part of the supply effort in the weeks after June 6. One of the groups I write about in the book is a group called the Red Ball Express, a truck convoy that was driven primarily by Black truck drivers. They're the ones who helped to move supplies from the beaches in Normandy and the port in Cherbourg across France and eventually into Germany. They moved 400,000 tons of ammunition, food, and fuel in those weeks and months after D-Day. And so quite literally, almost everything that moves to the front passes through the hands of at least one Black American. Back across the channel, in the port of Southampton, one of the busiest ports in the world at the time, almost everyone working there among American troops are Black troops as well. They're the ones who are loading the cargo on these ships, then gets transported across the channel. And so if you look at just the sort of D-Day and the weeks after it from that perspective, every member of the military had to play their own part. And so this argument takes nothing away from the bravery and sacrifices of combat soldiers. But the reality is combat soldiers need bullets. They need grenades. They need oil and gasoline for their vehicles. They need boots. They need there's so many supplies that any military needs, and that without that, it grounds to a halt. And Black troops were the lifeline. They were the backbone of the Allies' supply effort. And so that's why one of the arguments I make in the book is that without these Black supply troops, America and the Allies could not have won the war in the way that they did, and certainly not in the time frame that they did. And part of what makes me feel more comfortable making the argument is that it was recognized at the time. Black newspapers had a number of war correspondents that were embedded with the Black units. And what's nice about using those as sources is they give you a different perspective on what the most important stories from the war were. So there was a reporter named Ollie Stewart that was embedded with some of these units. And he talked about what he called the miracle of supply and how it didn't get a lot of press. It wasn't a sexy story, but these supply troops were the ones that were moving supplies most efficiently and most successfully. And that among the military personnel, the officers, the generals, they recognize the importance of supply. They're the ones that understood that you have to win a war, you have to do it in this way. And so it ends up being in the book, it felt to me like a very nerdy military history argument, because at one point I'm talking about how many horses versus trucks the German military had. Mm-hmm. We sometimes talk about the Blitzkrieg with the German military and how they're so effective at lightning warfare. But by 1944, once the French railway system is in ruins, the Germans actually have more horses than they do trucks, so they can't move their supplies with the same kind of efficiency that the Americans can. And so each of those parts of the story, I think, is a building block that helps us understand, okay, wait a minute, World War II wasn't just combat, it wasn't just people storming beaches, but it was this massive logistical effort to get supplies where they needed to be, and that logistical effort would not have been possible without Black troops.
Do you think the soldiers that you mentioned, war correspondents, and I'm very interested in these guys too, the units that did get into combat, and there are a number of exceptions to the general rule, and I think, you know, like when I study the USCT in the Civil War, there's, you know, they essentially function the same way and do the same job as white troops. Some demonstrate great bravery, some run away, some fight well, some don't, some win, some lose, you know, and that's they're very typical in that regard. So the Black soldiers that do get into combat, would you say that they're typical, one, and B, would you say that the reports of Black units that are in combat, do they reach the mainstream press? I suspect that they reach the Black press pretty clearly, but do they reach the mainstream press in the same sort of ways? And is that in any way kind of allowing the rest of white America, which is the United States is, I'd say, roughly 90% white in the 1940s, would that allow the rest of white America to like begin to change their perceptions of Blacks in combat?
The second part of the question first, yes, these black combat troops definitely showed up in black newspapers, which I guess is obvious, but they were well represented there, and powerfully so. I think for black newspapers, they understood how much these black troops were fighting for. In white newspapers, unfortunately, they didn't show up with great frequency unless something went wrong. And so there was a flare-up around the Tuskegee Airmen initially, where one of the first commanders said, after they had their first combat experience, that these black pilots didn't have what it takes to be able to be effective combat pilots, that they didn't react quickly enough. And so that ends up being kind of almost a PR battle that plays out. You have the black press on one side saying, hey, wait a minute, like they succeeded in some cases, they fell short in other cases, but this was also their first experience. Let's give them some time to see how this plays out. That goes up against Time magazine and some other reports that get published in other newspapers that are pretty harshly critical of the Tuskegee Airmen. Or there are a couple infantry units that black infantry units that encounter similar hostility in the white press. For other groups, they don't get the same attention that they do in the black press. So a group like the 761st Tank Battalion that was nicknamed the Black Panthers, that shows up extensively in the black press because they have war correspondents that are embedded with them. They receive only fleeting mentions at all in the white press. Similarly with the Black Marines, the Montfort Point Marines, who fight bravely at Iwo Jima and Saipan with great acknowledgement and commendation by the Marine Corps Commandant at the time. That shows up a lot in the black press, but not much in the white press. And again, I think for us as historians, it's why, and for students of this, why it's so important to look at different kinds of sources. If you looked only at white newspapers from this era or white magazines, you would have hardly any sense that there are more than a million black men and women serving their country during the World War II, because those stories just didn't show up there with the same kind of frequency. And so that's why it's so important to be able to tell the stories also from the black press. I'm forgetting the first part of the question. It was related to the combat units in some way.
Oh yeah, if you found them to be typical relative to the white units.
Yes. Yeah. I think similar to what you've described from the Civil War, you had some units that were successful in combat, some that were unsuccessful, and some that were a mix, depending on the conditions. Mm-hmm. I think in World War II, the 92nd Infantry is the one that got the harshest reporting at the time, and I think in the years afterwards, because they were in some really difficult fighting situations, and they didn't gained as much forward ground as their leaders wanted them to. But also a comparable white unit wouldn't necessarily have done any better. And when you kind of drill down a little bit, they had officers that were being rotated constantly. They had some of their white officers who were openly racist and didn't exactly engender a lot of morale or fighting spirit in their men. But by and large, the black troops were typical in terms of performance. But I think what was atypical is that to a person, they understood how much they had on their shoulders. They understood they weren't just fighting against enemy troops, but they're also fighting to prove that Black Americans could do this, particularly a group like the Tuskegee Airmen. They recognized every time they went up in the air that if they failed, it could be generations before Black men had the opportunity to be combat pilots again.
All of this leads me to my last question I wanted to ask you. We talk about the infrequency of their appearance in the press. And then, of course, because of that, if you don't look at all the sources, like you said, it's important to look at the Black stories, Black experiences of the war, so you can get a more comprehensive understanding of war and Americans' involvement in it. But like I was telling you earlier on, I mean, I didn't learn any of this stuff in high school. And if you look to the press, you know, Time, Life magazine, for example, the New York Times, for example, and you don't see these guys in there, you would come away with the idea that Black people didn't have as much involvement. So that brings me to the popular memory question, which is the question I always like to ask. That's kind of my niche field, this understanding after the fact of the contributions and whether Blacks demonstrated patriotism during this period or what have you. I feel that only recently, and I mean this in the last generation, really, that popular culture has turned their lens onto the Black experience in the war. I know Spike Lee made a movie about it. I know there's been some various other things about Black soldiers in World War II. This recent thing that we were talking about, Masters of the Air, that has an episode. There's been a few other things that have dealt with Black soldiers and sailors in some regards. What are your thoughts about popular memory and how we understand World War II now that we're 2-3 generations after the fact?
I think your general sense is right. I haven't studied the more recent media in detail, but just anecdotally, I feel like there have been many more documentaries and good books about the Tuskegee Airmen, about the 761st Black Panther Tank Battalion I mentioned, about the Montford Point Marines, about the largest women's unit that served, the 6888 Central Postal Direct Battalion. I think there's a movie in the works about them, all of which I'm encouraged by. I think each one of those is an important part of the story. And I'm of the perspective that the more history we have, the better, that we need more of these different perspectives in different media formats as well to give different people opportunities to engage with it. I think part of it is part of this kind of larger historical moment of trying to tell a more full and accurate version of American history. I think particularly in the last 10 years, more attention has been paid to African-American history, which also has run parallel to the attacks on African-American history and critical race theory, which I think is not coincidental. But I think on the encouraging side, there have been more good faith efforts to tell American history from broad and multiracial perspectives. I think for me, the thing that really strikes me, having done the research on the book, is how long that trajectory is. That in those years after World War II, Black veterans and their families obviously know what they've done to help win the war, but they come back to such hostility in the United States and such obvious efforts to write them out of the story that they feel like their stories aren't worth sharing. They not only have experienced the same traumas of war that white veterans have, but they come back to experience literal attacks on Black veterans, in some cases because they're wearing their uniforms, that they certainly aren't regarded as the greatest generation at that time. They're not treated in that way. They're not welcomed back as heroes. And that means that they don't tell their stories. I've talked to a number of people who are our age, who've had their grandparents or uncles or fathers, Black fathers who served in the war, who never told their stories about World War II because they didn't feel like they were stories that were worth telling. They were made to almost feel ashamed of their military service. Part of what happens is you have groups of veterans, Black veterans, who come together and start holding reunions and start telling their own stories. So the Tuskegee Airmen first start meeting in 1970 in a Detroit home to start holding their first reunions and eventually start to hold larger national reunions. And so a lot of the popular media that we have today, I think, owes a debt to those veterans being willing to tell their own stories and refusing to be silenced and forgotten. I think for us as historians, part of our obligation is to give voice to those stories as much as possible and make sure that they reach as many different audiences as possible. Because the more that we can put those stories in the foreground, I think we get a much clearer, more nuanced, and more honest understanding of what World War II is actually about. I think the greatest service we can have is having a simplified, sanitized version of World War II or of any period of history, because that doesn't give us a very firm foundation or footing to understand what happened then. And if we don't understand what happened then, we lose the ability to reckon honestly with the kind of things we're experiencing today.
Yeah, you know, this is the advice I give to my students all the time, is that you have to have a comprehensive take on this stuff. And if there are things that are unsavory in American history, fine, you need to understand those. This is, you need to understand everything about American history. And I do believe that there are critics who would say that, you know, emphasizing the Black experience in World War II detracts from the broader story of World War II, because it's a smaller group of people and the population is roughly around 10%. And, you know, the larger population is what we should be emphasizing. And so you're taking away from that. And I don't really necessarily see it as a zero sum game like this. I see it more as a, you know, what you're doing is you're adding another dimension. You're adding another layer on to the analysis of this event. And so it's not taking away from one thing. It's adding to something. And you get a broader picture of the American experience, the human experience at war, which I think is a positive value added. And so, you know, and listen, when I'm in my, you know, I teach a U.S. history survey. I mean, I can't talk about everything. I have to make choices, as I'm sure you do. You have to make choices in your classes, what you show them and what you don't. If I can't get to something, and I always encourage them to use what I teach as a springboard, for them to go and read more, to buy books, to you know, watch documentaries, to do whatever, just to enhance what they've already learned. But you know, Matt, I appreciate you coming on the show. This has been a really interesting conversation, and like I said, when I do my World War II unit, I'm going to have my students come and listen, because I think this is great. I'm definitely going to encourage them to read the book and, or at least read my review of it, which is positive. So I'm definitely going to have them do that. But thanks a lot for coming on. I really appreciate it, man. Thanks for taking your time.
Yeah. Thanks for inviting me. And it was a really wonderful conversation. I appreciate it. And please reach out if your students have any questions.
I certainly will. Thank you so much.
Thank you.